Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day.
Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, brought to you by The Nation Magazine and TheNation.com. I'm Chris Hayes, Washington editor of The Nation. Each week here on The Breakdown, we take your questions via Twitter at Chris L. Hayes or via email at TheBreakdown@TheNation.com. The way it works is this. You send us questions about what's perplexing you this week in Washington, and we try to break it down.
Will I run to the rock? Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord.
Hello, welcome back to The Breakdown, week 49, episode 49 in the Collector Series. This week's question comes via email from Grant Gulveson from Galesburg, Illinois. And he basically says, why are state pension programs unfunded and are they unfunded? Recently, he writes, the GOP state governor's assault on public sector workers has included frequent reference to so-called unfunded public pension programs. Mainstream media coverage on the topic has done little to clarify what precisely is meant by unfunded. Are all state pension programs unfunded? Whose idea was it to make them unfunded, and why? And finally, are there any state pension programs unfunded or otherwise that are not currently facing a crisis? It's a great set of questions. It's been so much in the news recently, the tide of red ink that people are ringing the alarm bell about, particularly at the state level, states like New Jersey and Ohio and Wisconsin, where there's battles over austerity and looming in the background, are dire warnings, particularly from the governors of those states, about the fiscal future of the state depending on the pension obligations it has to pay out. Well, we just so happen to have someone on the line who has just published a paper on this topic. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He's frequently cited in economics reporting in a wide variety of publications, New York Times, Washington Post, etc. His latest two books are False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and most recently, Taking Economics Seriously. Dean, thanks so much for joining us on The Breakdown.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so let's start out super basic. Take me through the structure of a state pension fund, who it's for, and how it works if we're talking about what are the most common, which are what we call defined benefit pension programs.
Well, the basic story with the defined benefit pension is that workers accrue a certain pension based on the amount of time they've worked there. So usually you have to be there some period of time to get anything. Typically it's about 5 years, anything in the defined benefit pension. Usually you walk away with some lump sum if you leave earlier. But let's say it's 5 years, that'd be typical. Then for each additional year you work, you'll get a larger percentage of your pay, and then the pay that they use to calculate that is usually the average of, say, your last 3, your last 5 years, some are unusual, and just say your last 1 year. And when you could retire also usually depends on your years of service. In some cases, you could retire after 30 years of service, even if you're just in your, say, mid-50s. That's been a highlight in the publicity campaign against these pensions. The number of people who actually can take retirement at those early ages tend to be relatively few, except in the case of police and fire, who often are in a situation where they can retire relatively early.
So just so that we're clear about the structure of this, David K. Johnson had a really good piece talking about the word contribution, because you see this term thrown around a lot. The structure of it is that the state is putting a certain amount of money from every paycheck into a pension fund. That is part of the compensation package. Instead of being paid directly, it's paid in a deferred way. And that money is diverted to a pension fund, right? And then it sits in that pension fund.
That's right. And a number of the people who have been going after these pensions have been saying, look, these public employees have these generous pensions. You don't have them. And of course, defined benefit pensions have become rare in the private sector over the last 30 years. They were common back in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s. You know, in recent decades, they have become rare. But the fact is, if you look at total compensation of public employees, what workers are getting in wages, in their health care benefits, in their pensions, a number of studies show that that's the same or less than comparably situated, educated, and experienced private sector employees. So workers are paying for this. They're getting lower wages in exchange for higher pension contributions.
It's a sort of a trade-off between income now and sort of security later. I mean, one of the things you hear, right, from people that are in the public sector often is that it is a big incentive inducement to know that you'll have some retirement security, particularly in an environment in which retirement security seems increasingly rare.
That's right. It's an inducement to workers. It also encourages loyalty. That's why the reason why so many firms used to offer defined benefit pensions, because you knew if you worked there longer, you'd accrue more in your pension. So it was a big incentive after someone had been in a firm 10 years, 15 years, maybe they could, you know, in principle, look and find a better job elsewhere. But if they know they stay there, they'll get a very good pension when they retire. That was a strong inducement to stay there. And that was why they were offered in the private sector. And that's a logic on the employer side for offering it in the public sector.
What we have now in private sector, just so that folks are clear on this, is what's called defined contribution, right? Which is that a certain amount of money is put into the fund every year and then it's managed and you're paid out based on what's in that pot at the end. But there's no guarantee of what you'll get. If you happen to have the bad luck of retiring, you know, the day after the stock market implodes because of a massive financial crisis brought on by Wall Street speculation, then you can find yourself with far, far less in retirement income than you had guessed.
That's right. There's both no guarantee, and there also tend to be much higher administrative costs associated with the defined contribution with 401k accounts than with the defined benefit accounts. And that has a big difference. So typically in defined contribution, the average administrative cost is somewhere around 1%, but there's many that are as high as 1.5%, even 2% a year. That eats in hugely into the amount that people are able to accumulate, even when they are in a situation where they or their employer are actually putting aside money year by year.
Okay, so I'm a teacher. I'm in a state that has a defined benefit pension plan, and I accrue every 2 weeks my paycheck, a little bit of money. Some portion of that paycheck goes towards this pension plan, and I accrue 25 years of seniority. I retire with my top salary, say $85,000 a year after 25 years in the system, and the pension's going to pay me some percentage of that. Let's say, you know, $65,000 a year, something like that, right?
You'd be very lucky.
I'd be very lucky. That's high. That's on a high end. So let's say half. Let's say it's going to pay me 50% of my final salary over the last 3 years. So I'm going to get $40,000 a year. So that's the structure, broadly speaking, of how this works. Now, what does it mean when we say, or when we worry about, the pension fund being unfunded? What does that word mean?
Okay, let me get to that in a second. But one important thing people should understand is a lot of public sector employees, somewhere around 30%, don't pay into Social Security. So when you hear whatever they're getting by way of their generous pension, that's their whole retirement. They're not paying into Social Security. Important thing for people to realize. But on the issue of being underfunded, in principle, what a fund's supposed to do is calculate its current liability. So the state shut down tomorrow. They know how long, you know, all the teachers worked, all the firefighters, all the various employees they have. How much would they owe those people over? And they usually look over the next 30 years. That's a somewhat arbitrary number. Some states do more, some states do less. 30 is the typical, though. So I say, how much would we owe people paying out over the next 30 years, given how long everyone's already worked? And then they compare that to how much money they have sitting, in effect, in the bank. It's not literally in the bank. It's in stocks. It's in bonds. But, you know, in various assets, how much do they have today? And then they ask, would that cover those liabilities over the next 30 years? And if the answer is no, then they're underfunded.
Okay, so just so we're clear, when that money is being paid into a pension fund, right? Like CalPERS fund is one you hear about a lot, right? Someone's managing that fund. I mean, it's money that's being invested, and presumably there's some rate of return, and that's part of the means by which the states are going to achieve the level of assets that they'll need to pay out the pensions, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what they're doing is they have it invested. You know, some of it's going to be in stocks, some of it will be in bonds, some of it will be short-term money. They invest some in private equity. They assign rates of return to those assets, each of those asset classes. And then they say, given the historic rates of return, this is what we're expecting going forward, will we meet our funding levels? Will we be able to fund all our liabilities over this 30-year time horizon?
Okay, so let's take a state, a fictional hypothetical state, since I don't have specific numbers in front of me. But when we say a state has a gap, right, there's an unfunded pension liability of, $12 billion or $20 billion. I mean, there's massive numbers being thrown around. That means that what they have right now under management is short of what they know based on their workforce they're going to need to pay out in the next 30 years. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I've read a lot of stuff that really does seem persuasively to convince me that this is a genuine problem, that there's a kind of a big mismatch between what is in the bank, as it were, and what the obligations are.
Well, there's two points to make about it. First off, every number you hear, I mean, I find people running around throwing numbers out there, $600 billion, $800 billion, some put it in the trillions. We can go into detail how you get different numbers. But these are big numbers. None of us are going to earn that much. Even Bill Gates is never going to see that much in his lifetime. So that sounds very, very scary. If you want to put that in a meaningful context, you say, how large is that relative to income over the next 30 years? Because that's kind of a relevant question. We don't have to pay this off tomorrow or next year or the year after. We've got 30 years. So how large is this number relative to income over the next 30 years? Now, my calculation, it's about 0.021%. Not trivial, 0.021% of, you know, income over the next 30 years, big number. But on the other hand, you know, base of comparison, if you like, the increase in annual spending on the military from 2000 before 9/11 to the present is about 1.7% of GDP. So, you know, we're talking about an additional amount that might have to be committed to pension funds that's about 1/8 of the size of the increase in the military budget. Another point to keep in mind, the reason why most of the funds face a big problem, the reason why most of them have a problem today is because of the plunge in the stock market following the collapse of the housing bubble. So it wasn't that they were being reckless. It wasn't that everyone's getting such generous benefits. They were in pretty good shape prior to 2008. Then the market took a big plunge, and suddenly they looked much worse. Now, the other point to make about that is the market has recovered a lot of that ground, but that's not recorded yet in many of the state numbers because there's often a considerable lag. A lot of the numbers that we're looking at today were numbers that were calculated back in 2009 when the market was still near its trough. So a lot of this has already been made up by the stock market. I mean, I have a crystal ball where it's going next year or anything, but if we just say, where's the market today, much of this shortfall has already been made up.
So the theory that you hear on the right is that this was overextension, that basically it was a really easy pact for governors to essentially agree to deferred compensation because they could then pass that off on the next governor when they were long out of office and those unfunded obligations would never touch them. So it was easy. They would hammer out these collective bargaining agreements with the public sector unions. They say, sure, we're going to give you all this. And in certain cases, like in New Jersey, they actually didn't even put the money in the pension fund. Like, they just spent it that year. So what role does that play versus the sort of downturn in Wall Street?
The overwhelming part of the story is the downturn on Wall Street. The vast majority of the funds were fully funded or very close to fully funded prior to the downturn. And again, you could say you have to anticipate a downturn, but this was really an extraordinary downturn.
Right.
So saying that they didn't anticipate, you know, kind of this near end of the world event, I'm a little hard pressed to give them too much blame for that. They were pretty well funded prior to the downturn. Again, you have the exceptions of New Jersey, Ohio, Illinois was probably in that boat, you know, so you could point to somewhere clearly they were doing, you know, much of what many of the conservatives blame them for. They were doing that. But those really are the exceptions.
That's interesting. So you have certain states that were, there's a small group of states in which they really were sort of playing this kind of fiscal game in which they were promising future compensation then spending the money that year. And then you have a much broader class of states whose balance sheets look bad because of the decline in the stock market.
Exactly. And that's really not a contestable point. I mean, you look at the data and you just go, let's assume, I did a little playing with this, you go, let's assume that they had just gotten very modest returns on their pension funds from 2007 through the present. The vast majority of these states would be fully funded today.
So are there any states, I guess I sort of finish off by asking, are there states that buck the trend? And if they did buck the trend, are there things we can learn about them bucking the trend in terms of, you know, particularly enlightened asset management or the structure of how the pension was set up?
Well, most of the ones that bucked the trend were in some ways overfunded previously. Wisconsin actually is in that boat. They're almost fully funded today. Now, I'd caution people, it's not obvious that that's what you really want to do, because in effect, if you overfund your pension, what that means is you're taxing people more today so that you have to tax them less in the future. And you might say that's good, but, you know, think about that. We don't tax people today to pre-fund schools, pre-fund the fire department. I mean, we generally think you want to pay for services as they go, and I think that would apply for pensions as well.
Right. And that's actually, that gets at the deep sort of philosophical issue here, right? Which is that the pensions are seen as this sort of legacy model that is now coming back to bite us. And now that, you know, we're entering this austerity era, it's time to like look at this, like the last bastion of this sort of cushy, profligate way of compensating workers. And it sounds like you're saying that the numbers don't support that view.
They don't support that view, and it's a lot of real sloppy thinking, because again, let's get back to this. A pension, what the state pays in a pension is in lieu of what it's paying people for their wages. This is straight economics. It just stands to reason. I'm looking at one job that will pay me $60,000 a year, another job will pay me $55,000, but they're going to give me the defined benefit pension. Well, am I willing to take that lower pay? Now, if we say, oh no, states shouldn't do that? Well, the point is, I don't care just about the money that the state's putting in. I also care about the guarantee, because I can't get that as a worker. I want someone to guarantee me a pension in retirement. That's very costly to get from the private sector. So in effect, what the state could do is it could take on risk at very little cost to itself, give its workers something of great value. And what that means is basically they're saving on pay. I mean, I remember when I was in grad school, we learned this. My professor, as far as I know, was no great liberal, might well have been a Reagan Republican. You know, this was the straight economics. So the idea was that the party that can more easily bear the risk, the employer, takes it on itself, giving something of great value to the workers, and in that way can get a lower wages. So if we just say, oh, no, states aren't going to do that, well, the implication would be is we're either going to have to pay more to get workers of the same quality, or we could pay the same, but we're going to get lower quality workers, because why would they take that job?
That's a really interesting point. I have not heard it phrased that way. And Dean Baker, who is a co-director of Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C., is an excellent person to go to for genuinely novel insights into economics. You can read his work in a number of places. He sometimes publishes for us at Nation Magazine. He writes a blog for Center for Economic Policy Research, which is CEPR.net. It's called Beat the Press, and he's quoted all the time. Dean Baker, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
The Breakdown is a weekly production of The Nation Magazine and TheNation.com. New audio casts are posted each Friday at TheNation.com and available on iTunes. The Breakdown was produced by Ryan Rafferty and yours truly. Senior producers at The Nation are Frank Reynolds and Emily Douglas. Comments and feedback should be sent to TheBreakdown at TheNation.com.
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to all on that day?